This is
John Nicholas.
October 18th, 1996. Exploring Sacred Space in the Space Age. Tape 1 of 1.
A soul can be imagined as a metaphorical place where religious experiences happen or where religions are experienced. So it's the significance of sacred space that I want to explore in this regard. Long ago, before the notion that we create our own reality became a New Age truism, Jung's case studies demonstrated how the psyche creates reality every day in the form of images, and that are its natural expression. In our creative activities, as we give concrete form and expression to our inner images, our fantasies and imaginal world become manifested in the other reality, the so-called real world. These soul images point beyond themselves and often provide insight, meaning, and a unique psychological perspective through which we begin to comprehend our place in the world. And it is through our unconscious we're saying, look, see, through this image and let it speak to you and let it inform you about yourself and the world. The process of amplification will follow the metaphor of a journey, not a linear journey. Not a journey to a specific destination or goal, but an inner journey into the archetypal realm, that place of original imprinting. The process will also be one of circumambulation, circling around the image of sacred space as it has appeared in our Western culture and is expressed in myth, alchemy, religion, history, as well as the dreams and psychic activities of modern individuals. So we will begin our study of the concept of sacred space and some of the ways in which it influenced Jung's life and personal growth and development. We will explore Jung's own myth of meaning as well as that which we all share. We will consider some of the typical aspects of sacred space and their relevance to the modern world. And we will continue our voyage paralleling yet another archetypal pattern, that which might broadly be interpreted as a homecoming, a coming home to ourselves, a return to the image of the original temnos, the sacred space of the family hearth. There is a need in our contemporary society to bring back the sacred into everyday life. In a time when one of our greatest social ills is the breakdown of the family and homelessness, a return to the understanding and reevaluating the ancient and universal truths and symbolic rituals is sorely needed. At the beginning of this century, the unconscious was still a largely unknown, unexplored territory, lying beyond our conscious concepts of time and space and causality. We live in an era characterized as the space age. Exploring the outer reaches of space, our celestial telescopes reveal that the universe is far more vast and far older than scientists had once imagined. The images of this other world were studied by Jung, who went far beyond the personal realm into that of the collective unconscious. Although no one knows for sure how far the universe extends, it ultimately remains a mystery. Humankind, however, has always had a need for containment. Boundaries that set limits and sacred space within which those rituals and religious ceremonies could be enacted to worship the infinite power beyond our grasp or understanding. We have a need for a relationship, a spiritual connection with the mysteries. The ancient astronomers studied the movements of the stars within an arc of the night sky known as the Templum, looking for auguries that would foretell favorable times for earthly endeavors. Intuitively, they sensed the connection between the movements of the heavenly bodies and the tides and seasons. The planets and the stars were the first gods and goddesses. Throughout the world, there have been special sites perceived as places of power. The gods and goddesses would decree through dreams and visions where they chose to reside and be worshipped. They settled on summits such as Mount Olympus. Poseidon chose those dramatic promontories overlooking the sea. Asclepius, the god of medicine, preferred a quiet pine grove as a place to practice dream incubation therapy and heal the sick. Occasionally, Zeus, the sky god, would dramatically make his presence felt by hurling a thunderbolt. The lightning-seared earth where the god had appeared would be set apart from profane everyday use. This sacred enclosure was known to the ancient Greeks as the temenos, from the Greek temen, which means to cut off or sever. Eventually, the image of the templum was transferred to this frame of reference. Our psyche needs such places. Throughout history, humankind has been creating sacred space for meditation and worship. The ancient Greeks originated this pattern in the form of a central circular hearth consecrated to the goddess Hestia. Daily sacrifices were made to her prior to eating. Much as we say grace before meals, the Greeks would say, "Here's to Hestia," or rather than saying cheers or something like that. A significant aspect of this simple shrine is the image of centrality and unity. In the major spiritual center of the ancient Greek world, Delphi, which was consecrated to the god Apollo, the fires of Hestia were kept burning continually, and the coals from this central source were used to light temple fires in deep and distant Greek colonies, thus maintaining a contact with the center. Symbolically, the spirit lives in the flame. A vestige of this symbolism is to be found in the ritual of transporting the Olympic torch to the various sites of the modern games. Now, what is the purpose of such rituals? Why have they been practiced in all cultures throughout the world? Clearly, they meet some deeply felt human need for spiritual connection. Sacred space provides a container for something to be born. It is a safe, protected place, a sanctuary, an asylum, as well as a place of worship. We need such places for spiritual renewal, for rebirth. Unlike other Olympian gods and goddesses, Hestia's significance was not in her deeds, but rather in her place. She was connected to the center, to the omphalos, to the navel stone of the universe. And this image of centrality is very important. Mountain Lake, the Pueblo chief in Taos, New Mexico, told Jung that he didn't quite understand white man's restlessness. Quote, "They are always seeking something. They are always full of unrest, always looking for something. What are they looking for?" Close quotes. Having no place and lacking a connection to the earth, such people sadly wander the world seeking roots, looking for soul connections. Jung concluded that these people were literally possessed, driven by demons, because they were not living a life that made sense. In contrast, the Pueblos greet their father, the sun, at dawn and help him to rise above the horizon and walk across the heaven. This significant religious ceremony daily offers meaning to their lives, giving them a dignified sense of divine responsibility. The spiritual challenge facing contemporary Americans is to rediscover or new meaningful forms to fulfill these ancient archetypal needs. And Annalise Zahn said to me, "I have no place and no identity. I feel alienated." Growing up as an army brat, he had lived in many parts of the world, but he had no place truly to call home. And there was no point of family origin from which he could draw ancestral strength. And now, in midlife, he felt lost, fearful, a stranger in a strange world. He no longer felt protected or safe. His soul was lonely. Jung had a deep understanding of such problems. Quote, "You can become a member of a society with 1,000 members, and you are still alone. The thing in you which should live is alone. Nobody touches it. Nobody knows it. You yourself don't know it. But it keeps stirring, and it disturbs you. It makes you restless, and it gives you no peace." Close quotes. The solution is to rediscover for ourselves the ancient wisdom of our ancestors. Our souls seek sacred places. One of the root words of the word religion, according to Jung, means to look back to our origins. Early 16th century manuscripts depicted the Garden of Eden, the mythic place of our beginning, as a womb. And by the way, Delphi is also the womb. We are born out into the world to wander and to suffer. So part of our need is to recreate the original safe place, to be reborn. Instinctively, people have long known that their warnings lead eventually to a pilgrimage, to a sacred place. Cathedrals oftentimes were built on the original sites of ancient temples and were holy places to which people walked. At Chartres in France, they completed their journey by walking the labyrinth, and in the same way, the ancient Greeks completed their journey to Eleusis, or Delphi, or elsewhere, by being initiated into the mysteries, into those ancient rites of spiritual transformation. The early Christians understood this to be a three-part path. The first part, similar to the beginning of analysis, was purgation, or cleansing, letting go of the care of the cares of the world. The second part was illumination, where standing at the center, one could meditate on the mandala, the rose window, and contemplate with clarity and peace a feeling of being centered, spiritually focused. And finally, it was a union, joining with God, as one walked back out into the world with a sense of renewal and connectedness. I just want to show you this wonderful image from Notre Dame de Paris, the rose window, the mandala. Can we have the lights again? I have often speculated that Switzerland itself, surrounded by the mountains and having maintained neutrality for centuries, is a natural Temenos. And I wondered if Jung could have had his psychology anywhere else at the time that he did, had he lived anywhere else. certain places have soul, and those environments hold certain psychic energy called mana, as Jung's home does in Kuznak, his lakeside retreat in Bulligan, and the original Jung Institute in Zurich. It was there that Jung kindled a spark. He launched a search to penetrate the mysteries of psychic wholeness. And now I'd like to show you some slides of that time. This is this first slide is walking down the Gladden Path to Jung's family home. Then, next slide, please. This is Jung's study. Next, please. This is the view of the lake that Jung enjoyed from his writing desk. Imagine all sorts of things come out of that water. The boathouse, and in the foreground, the remains of the little castle that Jung built. You can see how level the lake has dropped since that time. This is the original Jung Institute in Zurich. It's now the psychology club at 27 Gemeindestrasse. Can we have the lights again, please? So where is the Temenos today? In our modern world, we have lost this vital connection with the past. Unlike our ancient forebears, we lack the sense of totality of wholeness. Today, humankind, the microcosm, and the world of macrocosm have become split. Just as there is a split in the gestalt of our modern cosmos, so too we ourselves have become split off. Our modern technology has succeeded in splitting that which for the ancient Greeks was indivisible, the atom, atoma. In Greek means the individual. Our reference points of centering orientation have been erased. We live neither in the earth-centered nor the sun-centered cosmos of our ancestors. We lack the comfortable knowledge of the omphalos, the navel stone, being at the center and temenos of the known world, as at Delphi. Today, we have literally blasted ourselves off the face of the earth, defying even the grounding and centering force of gravity. Our astronauts have experienced the weightlessness and void of outer space. Where can we go from here? There is no solace in our exploration of the dead moon, yet we have gained a new perspective. For the first time, we have been able to view the Earth rise. Our space voyages have given us a new cosmic consciousness, a new image of the world, and it is a non-human, distant, remote, and alien. We are now living in a universe without a center. Where is the Temenos to be found in the modern world? Today, we are witnessing a period that has been likened to a new renaissance of consciousness. It is a period of reawakening and renewal of the spiritual search. It has given rise to many new and quasi-religious and any new and number of self-appointed gurus and spiritual healers. Among the men of science and culture, there is a general interest in mind-expanding drugs, altered states of consciousness, meditation, mystic states, parapsychology, Eastern religions, yoga, I Ching, Tarot, and all manner of esoteric psychological systems, all of which point to the reaction to the Apollonian mode which has for so long been dominating Western intellectual life. We are seeing a resurgence of the Dionysian. As the I Ching, the Book of Changes, shows, Everything ascetic, all established religions, all established institutions and constructions, indeed, everything patterned is only the framework in which the changes move. Yet we have always had a need to reconstruct the very framework which change can take place. It is as though there were an inherent human need not only to contain the chaotic life forces of the universe, but also be contained. Some people, sensing a need for inward growth and awareness, have taken drug trips. Many embarked upon these chemical journeys quite unconsciously, without realizing the dangers. In their search for the Dionysian experience, many had failed to realize that the archetype embodies the twin poles of inspiration and madness. Rather naively, Timothy Leary encouraged his followers to tune in, and drop out. It was only later that he came to realize that the fear and the confusion of the LSD experience sometimes resulted in psychosis. Subsequently, he advised his fellow psychedelic pioneers that it was tremendously, quote, tremendously important that the LSD session be conducted in a protected place, and that the person be prepared, and that he have an experienced and understanding guide to support and to shield him from intrusion, close quotes. In other words, in psychological terms, he recognized the need to create a temenos. In The Living Symbol, a case study of the process of individuation, Gerhard Adler illustrates how the analytical situation itself is a temenos, within which the numinous experience of transmutation can take place. Quote, for it is inside the protective magic circle, the vast hermeticon, or philosophical egg, of the analytical relationship that the process of integration is experienced. The dialectical relationship between analyst and liaison is in itself an archetypal situation. It is a place of gestation and integration. Its ideal aim is to produce the divine child, the integrated self. Once established, the analytical situation can transcend time and space. This will be particularly so when the process of individuation has become active, close quotes. The ability of the analytical situation to transcend time and space is also vitally important. It means that ultimately the individual must recreate or rediscover that quiet, protected place within which is the personal, eternal temenos. Now, although it's a danger of generalizing from the specific, these symbols are archetypal and therefore universal. Therefore, anybody who is undergoing a similar process of developing a relationship with the unconscious will encounter similar material. And here are a few examples from a dream series of Lydia, a 50-year-old Italian woman who was in analysis for the Jung in Rome. Her third dream begins, quote, I'm in America with my husband in a large paved courtyard, close quotes. Lydia is at an age in which she is reflecting upon and questioning her life and the long clash between her psychological reality and that of others, especially her husband, with whom she has an ambivalent relationship, characterized by mixed feelings of fondness and hatred. Her initial dream has suggested the theme of a journey, And this image is a frequent motif symbolizing the archetype of the way. This is an inner journey, a voyage of discovery. She could have gone anywhere, but the dream takes her to America, a place which signifies for her both freedom and conflict, for where internal conflict functions in a system of checks and balances. She also associates America as being the new world, which points to her new beginning, a new life. And in the midst of her inner America, she needs to deal with the conflicted marital relationship in a large paved courtyard. This is the image of the temenos. And it is constellated at this particular time, presenting a safe, enclosed container, a protected space for the transformation to take place. Analysis is a challenge and a confrontation of old, outmoded attitudes, and the ego needs to be protected so as to be able to withstand the strain of this encounter. The analytical situation itself represents temenos, and it is within this safe environment that the liaison can open up, share secret fears and anxieties, and face uncomfortable truths that, though painful, eventually lead to change and healing. This is the initial phase of analysis that Jung equated with the confessional. By Lydia's sixth dream, we can note the progress is being made. Already, her relationship to her husband is changing. She's aware of his presence, one might say his influence, even though she does not really see him. Thus, she has become to be aware of the process of projection. More significantly for our purposes, however, is a further amplification of the temenos as temple. Quote, "I am with my husband, though he doesn't appear. I dig and find myself before a sculptured terracotta facade in the form of an Etruscan temple. Then I see a Roman construction and find some crucifixes. I enter the temple and I see some objects on the floor under the tables, three under each table. I gather them up and wrap one of them, the stone bust of a woman with large breasts, to send home. My husband, however, addresses it to the place where we are. I realize this, and I think it's ridiculous." End of dream. Now, there's a great deal of material in this little dream, but we will simply focus on the images of the temenos. Firstly, she is engaged in a spiritual exploration, and her digging leads her to three distinct cultures, Etruscan, Roman, and Christian. The first is a facade, a mask. Naturally, as an Italian, she was familiar with Etruscan history and culture, but her most important association was the language. For unlike other dead languages, Etruscan apparently has never been deciphered. So we are dealing with a mystery, something which is incomprehensible and beyond interpretation. The dream indicates, however, that this is also a mask or a disguise, and that behind it is something much more familiar and better known, the Roman. It seems that she needs to get beyond her resistances and blockage that it would lead her to believe that the task is too difficult and beyond her ability to comprehend. The discovery of the cross had a very obvious meaning compared to the obscurity of the Etruscan facade. It was alive and vital and related directly to her spiritual and emotional problems. It was not only the cross that she was bearing, but on a deeper level, also a symbol of death and resurrection. of transformation through suffering. Thus, the cross is indicative of her conflict where she is split, and yet it also points to the possibility of change. It is only by accepting her cross that Lydia will be able to overcome the incommunicality represented by the Etruscan facade. The dream emphasized, however, that this process of transformation needs to take place within a temple, a place charged with the spiritual energy of many cultures. This is the Temenos. This is the Temenos in its aspect of sacred precinct. It provides that safe, secure protection where one can approach the larger questions of life from a universal perspective, beyond one's individual concerns. It is a place of introversion, reflection, and contemplation. Analysis also provides a safe place in which to heal the insecurity of a wounded childhood. And of course, it would take us far too afield to discuss the obvious Oedipal aspects of the dream, but they are vitally important. For the dreamer needs to resolve, however, her relationship with her own mother and her sense of being a woman that clearly affected her troubled marriage. Suffice it for us to note the strange ending of the dream. The patient decides to take one of the objects found under the table, a stone bust of a woman with large breasts, and to send it home. But the husband, that is her animus, causes her to incorrectly address it to the temple. Thus, her inner masculine causes her to make a mistake. And even though she realizes it is ridiculous, effectively it keeps her stuck. And in so doing, she is not dealing with the personal aspects of her problem, where they need to be addressed, namely at home. I think this often happens in analysis with both men and women, especially those who are somewhat intellectual in their orientation. Sometimes they have significant insights in their dreams. They relish the archetypal associations and the wealth of collective unconscious, but they fail to integrate these insights into their everyday life. They contemplate, they compartmentalize their analysis, and their relationships continue to suffer. Fortunately, when either analyst or analyzon make a mistake, the subsequent dreams usually correct it. If one pays close attention, one generally gets right back on track. Indeed, in this dream series, the following dream dealt primarily with the theme of mother, forcing Lydia to face her problems at home. Thus, the analyst can help activate the process of individuation by creating enabling space within which the analyzon can encounter the self. There will be perhaps times when, in this transference, when the analyst may be both father and mother. Both paternal and maternal are within the archetypal container of the relationship. In our circumambulation of the Temenos, we have noted the need for the lost sacred place in our split, rationalistic, materialistic, and technologically dominated world. We have traced its origins to the archetypal natures of the pre-Olympian Greeks and explored its meaning mythologically. We have seen its many forms and its sublime expression in the mysteries and witness man's modern search for the transformation in the drug experience and the occult. We have noted its relevance in the analytical situation and the individuation process. And now in the final circle, we are led back to Jung himself. His life and his late thoughts and especially to his personal temnos, Bullion. In spite of the considerable creativity he put into his scientific work and psychological writing, Jung found words somehow inadequate to fully express his most innermost thoughts and the knowledge that he had acquired during his lifetime. Quote, I had to make a confession of the faith in stone, he recalls in his autobiography. And that was the beginning of the tower, the house he built at Bullion on the shores of Lake Zurich. The building of the tower and living in it had a transformative effect from the very beginning. And as he cites in his memoirs, quote, I felt the tower was in some way a place of maturation, a maternal womb, or a maternal figure in which I could become what I was, what I am, and what I will be. It gave me the feeling as if I were being reborn in stone. It is thus a concretization of the individuation process. Close quotes. Although he built the house in sections over the years, it was not until he had completed that he realized how all the parts fit together in a meaningful form, that he had created a symbol of psychic wholeness. Thus, he discovered quite naturally and spontaneously that the mandala is produced from two sources, the unconscious and life itself. At Bullion, Jung felt most himself. Without electric light, heating, or running water, he lived like a man of the 16th century. Modestly and in harmony with nature, it was here that Jung linked up with his ancestors and the meaning they carried for him, both his psychological work and his personal life. In this temenos, Jung lived the life with utter devotion to the self. Can we have this little slice, please? This is the tower at Bullion, which he began in 1923. It was important for Jung that he built part of his tower with his own hands, learning from local craftsmen the art of cutting stone and working it himself as a mason. At Bullion, he wrote, I am in the midst of my true life, and I am most deeply myself. Could we have the lights now? One of Jung's greatest contributions to modern psychology is that he broke new ground and liberated psychology from the confines of Freud's late 19th century rationalism and scientific materialism. His aim was also to free medical psychology from its subjective and reductionistic bias, making it possible to understand the unconscious as both an objective and collective psyche. Even the term unconscious, rather than Freud's preference for subconscious, is indicative of the different attitudes. Subconscious suggests something less than, beneath or below, as subhuman or alien, perhaps as the Spanish conquistadors regarded the Indians. Whereas Jung's term unconscious is much more natural and lacks any pejorative connotation. Every true and major scientific breakthrough encounters resistance from the establishment. And so too it was with Jung's discovery of the collective unconscious. This was particularly apparent during his Tavistock lectures that he gave in London in 1935. At one point in the discussion, a frustrated Jung declared that in their ignorance, they regarded him as just a sorcerer. Quote, "They said it in the Middle Ages," he complained. "They said, how can you see Jupiter has satellites? If you reply that you have a telescope, what is a telescope to a medieval audience?" Close quotes. Thus, Jung took great pains to explain to this audience of 200 medical doctors and psychiatrists that unfortunately their unawareness of archetypal pattern found in Oriental symbolism, Chinese and Sanskrit literature, and ancient medieval manuscripts would render it impossible to understand his psychology and method of dream interpretation, of amplification of its symbolic imagery. Quote, "That is the great trouble," he said. "There is such a gap between what is usually known of these things and what I have worked on all these years. And if I were to speak of this, even before a medical audience, I might as well talk Chinese." Close quotes. The general understanding and appreciation of Jungian psychology has come a long way since Jung gave those introductory lectures nearly 60 years ago. Jung was very much ahead of his time. Yet psychology is still a very young science, and perhaps now we need to reorient ourselves and consider in a fresh light the maps that we have inherited from psychology's pioneers. Jung had suggested that such an approach when he wrote, quote, "The pioneer in a new field rarely has the good fortune to be able to draw valid conclusions from his total experience. The efforts and exertions, the doubts and uncertainties of his voyage of discovery have penetrated his marrow too deeply to allow him the perspective and clarity which are necessary for a comprehensive presentation. Those of the second generation who base their work on the groping attempts, the chance hits, the circuitous approaches, the half-truths, and the mistakes of the pioneer are less burdened and can take more direct roads and envision further goals. They are able to cast off many doubts and hesitations, concentrate on essentials, and in this way map a simpler and clearer picture of the newly discovered territory. This simplification and clarification redound to the benefit of the third generation, who are thus equipped from the outset with an all-over chart. And with this chart, they are enabled to formulate new problems, mark out the boundary lines much more sharply than ever before." Close quotes. So, how good are the charts that we have inherited? How can they best be utilized to serve our needs today? Since all maps are in some way inadequate, being projections of the map maker and his or her view of the landscape, it's important that we question them. Certain things seem relevant and important to us may have been overlooked or neglected. You may discover a new route, a better route, or a more satisfying one to your needs. In teaching, in my workshops, and in the practice of psychotherapy, I often encourage people to draw a map. This is especially useful when someone is feeling lost, disoriented, wanting to make a fresh start, but not knowing how to do it or how to begin. It's also a very practical device. Just as on those large-scale city maps, or you sometimes see them on like campus, where a red arrow indicates you are here, it's very important to know where here is. At least then you will know where you are and perhaps gain some idea of where you want to go. Any map, no matter how inadequate, is better than no map. But perhaps the best map is the one we create for ourselves. Typically, there are two opposing attitudes that people bring into analysis. Some individuals, especially thinking types, come in with a specific agenda, what they want to work on and what they wish to accomplish during the course of analysis. They may have time or money concerns or constraints, insisting that their particular goals be accomplished within 10 sessions, particularly these days with managed care. These people are generally most difficult to work with because their defenses are so great and their need to control causes tremendous resistances. Others come in on their knees. They've tried everything and nothing works. Analysis is the court of last resort. Help me, they implore. Guide me. I'm lost. In both cases, the initial meetings are usually quite therapeutic. Just having a place where you can unburden your soul is healing. There's a cathartic and cleansing release, being able to articulate and share your concerns and troubles. But then very early in the process, synchronistic, and it came at a time in Jung's life when he desperately needed help, for he was on the brink of a psychotic breakdown and potentially suicidal. As so often happens, the breakthrough was heralded in dreams. In his autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, he tells of that terrifying time. Quote, only gradually did I discover what the mandala is. Formation, transformation, eternal minds, eternal recreation. That is from Faust. My mandalas were cryptograms. And in them I saw the self that is my whole being actively at work. I had a distinct feeling that there was something central, and I had acquired them through a living conception of the self. The monad, which I am, and which is my world, the microcosmic nature of the psyche. Close quotes. While Jung was working on these mandalas, he repeatedly asked himself, where is this process leading, and what is its goal? His unconscious attention was to continue the scientific investigation of myth, which he had begun with Symbols of Transformation. But when he began drawing the mandalas, he was compelled to acknowledge the process of the unconscious was leading him back to a single point, the midpoint, and it became increasingly clear to him that the mandala is the center. Quote, it is the exponent of all the paths. It is the path to the center, to individuation. The goal of psychic development is the self. There is no linear evolution. There is only a circumambulation of the self. Uniform development exists at most only at the beginning. Later, everything points toward the center. In finding the mandala as an expression of the self, I had attained what was for me the ultimate. Perhaps someone knows more, but not I. Close quotes. Through his work on the mandalas and subsequent meaningful dream motifs, emphasizing the significance of the center, Jung realized that the goal had been revealed. Quote, one could not go beyond the center. The center is the goal, and everything is directed to the that center. Close quotes. In this way, he came to understand that the self is the principle, the archetype of orientation and meaning. Therein lies its healing function. This insight signifies an approach to the center and therefore to the goal. And out of this first emerged my personal inkling of my personal myth. Close quotes. Jung kindled a spark and launched a search to penetrate the mysteries of psychic wholeness. He expressed this need of mission in his last words, written 10 days before he died. Quote, "Our actual knowledge of the unconscious shows that it is a natural phenomenon, and that like nature herself, it is at very least neutral. It contains all aspects of human nature, light and dark, beautiful and ugly, good and evil, profound and silly. The study of the individual as well as collective symbolism is an enormous task, and one that has not yet been mastered. But a beginning has been made, and early results are encouraging, and they seem to indicate an answer to many so far unanswered questions of present-day mankind." Close quotes. And now, as we approach the 21st century, throughout the world, the work that Jung began continues, and his spirit is very much alive. Spiritual activity, like the psyche itself, transcends time and space, just as those ancient and faraway sacred sites drew pilgrims from afar to expand their world beyond this physical beyond their physical bodies and their ordinary lives, so we too seek space for solitude and meditation, asylum and healing, as we continue the work that he, C.G. Jung, has begun. Thank you.
In my feelings that in introducing John,
I'm currently searching for the sacred.
Oh, really?
Without any religion associated with it, by taking exercise.
Oh, really?
Yes, William James did this.
Wow, that's fascinating. Where did you read that?
In the Atlantic magazine.
Oh, really? The current issue?
No, no, it's the old one.
Oh, I see.
But yes, he deliberately wanted the experience of the sacred,
yeah.
But he wanted it without any theology.
Yeah. I understand that. Oh, yeah.
Was I supposed to say something?
No, yeah, I don't know what the format is, really.
Well,
yeah.
He just did the same word.
Yeah, yeah.
The same form. Well, I mean, the format is that you should everybody has to ask one question.
No.
People there are allowed to go home. Oh, that isn't the format?
No, that's not.
What's the format again? I'm pretty sure I forgot. No, if you have any questions, please, feel free. You don't even have to finish the sentence. Half a sentence question.
And if I can't answer it, Peter will.
So there's that idea.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, please.
That is the way to create a mindset for these questions. Can we see the slides once?
Sure, yeah.
Oh, well, our slide expert.
This should be amusing.
That's a real high tech.
There we go.
There, I might say this about over the threshold to the Jung home. It's written in Latin: "Vocatus non vocatus, Deus et hieret." Bidden or unbidden, God will be here.
And I can add to it only that the house still looks just about like this, has looked all the time, and then the right part is split now, and the right part, Franz Jung lived there, his only son, until he died, this June actually,
yeah.
He died at age 87. And on the other side, Franz Jung's son, so the grandson of Jung, lived there with his family. Still a couple of dogs are roaming around the house. your study and his desk essentially sort of almost remained untouched. The desk stood in the living room at the Seeshasana. And Francium, who lived in that part of the house, really never did anything. He just left it. He used it. Mm-hmm. I sat in the chair once in his house.
I can imagine, yeah.
Is this house sort of like a museum?
No, it's not like a museum. It's a private home. People live in it. Yeah. I lived in the same town as Jung did. And only I did. I lived up on the hill. And his was down by the sea. Oh no! This castle was from where he used to play with the building a town. You see, yes, that's what.
There was a period from about 19. What would you say, John? When he broke with Freud, 1911 or so.
Yeah.
To 1917, when he
produced.
When he sort of went back to his own childhood structures and built these little places in sand out of pebbles by the lake, to put a concrete structure on the images that he encountered.
There now is a new institute in Kuznak. This was the old institute in Zurich, which is still housing the analytical psychology club. But after Jung's death, the town donated this wonderful Seehof, what they call a Siemens house. By the lake of Zurich and Kuznak. So there's a brand new Jung Institute there, which is Howell now, but it's all not all that brand new, but about 15 years, maybe. Yeah.
Is it true, John, I heard that it was much easier to graduate from this?
Next slide. Oh, this was the on the road to Bulligan.
Yeah, this is Lake Zurich on an ordinary summer day.
Yeah. Well, do you have the slide of Bulligan? Yeah. There. That's his tower, you see.
This is not my dog, Hans. This is Jung's dog.
Uh-huh.
Did he love dogs?
Yes, he did. Yeah.
And he loves Lake Lumberini.
Oh, he used to sail on the lake every time. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jung built Bulligan, sort of starting as John had described, the tower on the left side is the original structure of the tower. That, for many, many years, stood alone. And is a round structure where in the bottom, covering the whole tower, is the kitchen. And then there are various small rooms in the upstairs to sleep, all without heat, without water, without anything. Mm-hmm. And many of the rooms, the small rooms, Jung painted his own inner images, like this guiding figure, Philemon, one has this painting on the wall. So it's quite interesting to see. And then as years went on, he added in various periods of his life, and I think finally, Bulligan, as it is now, was only finished in 57.
53. Yeah.
Is Marie Louise von France's tower close by?
Yeah, it's not far.
Yeah, right. Same town.
Actually, she built a square tower instead of a round tower.
Yeah.
She didn't want to be too simple.
Yeah, probably not. She didn't want to compete.
I don't know, competition or expert.
Yes, he did. A lot of his creative writing was down there.
You're building a bombshell.
That was a very nice suggestion, by the way. I think I might share with you something that I didn't get into the talk, but is I think quite appropriate because of Jung being in the 21st century. This is a letter that he wrote in 53 when a biographer from of Einstein wrote him. He said, I think you got to know Albert Einstein, and would you please tell me about it?" So Jung writes, "Yeah, I got to know I got to know Albert Einstein through one of his pupils, if I remember correctly. Professor Einstein was my guest on several occasions at dinner." You just imagine this. Einstein and Jung having dinner together. Jeez. And also present was Eugene Bleuler, who was Jung's boss at the time. A psychiatrist and his former chief. These were very early days when Einstein was developing his first theory of relativity. He tried to instill into us the elements of it, more or less successfully. As non-mathematicians, we psychiatrists had difficulty in following his argument. Even so, I understood enough to form a powerful impression of him. It was, above all, the simplicity and the directness of his genius as a thinker that impressed me mightily and exerted a lasting influence on my own intellectual work. It was Einstein who first started me off thinking about the possibility of relativity of time as well as space, and their psychic conditionality. More than 30 years later, this stimulus led to my relation with the physicist Professor Pauli and to my thesis of psychic synchronicity. With Einstein's departure from Zurich, my relation with him ceased, and I hardly think he has any recollection of me. One can scarcely imagine a greater contrast than that between mathematical and psychological mentality. The one is extremely quantitative, and the other just as extremely qualitative. Here's Cecily, C.G. Jung. They're great.
He never went to graduate school.
Oh, boy. I don't know whether he did or not. I think. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Question.
Yes.
Just following on when you talked about the Navajo.
Yeah.
Quote,
yeah. Mountain Lake. Yeah. Mountain Lake.
Yeah, you've gone forward to suggest that there was certain thrusts of being able to do certain things, gestures and so forth. You didn't really develop it much, you moved on, but there was some kind of, I was wondering how you feel Jungians might have something to do with, or not to do with, generating any forms or people in any way.
Yes. Yeah, well, Peter, maybe you can answer that question because I don't fully understand.
Or was that a really good question?
I understand you want to know whether Jungians in their philosophy or in their depth psychology has developed something similar to Navajo traditional thinking or their dream world or their...
Not if they developed it, but if there's any sense that it might have a role to play in that way or not. The Navajo seems particularly extroverted in some way. I mean, they reckon with the sun itself, not an image of the sun. Itself.
Yeah.
There's something that they put into the sun, a holy person who lived there a long time ago.
Well, that was their father.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are we talking Navajos or Pueblos?
Yeah,
Pueblos.
Pueblos.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Peter?
Oh, I mean, I have no, Jonathan, I have no answer to that question. I mean, it's a mega question. I'm not familiar with Pueblo tradition, and so I can't really make that crossing.
But the point that I wanted to make was that, that they knew what their place was in the world, you know. See, and that's what.
I mean, historically, in his travels, Jung was so impressed by getting out of this relatively small structure of Switzerland.
Yeah.
In encountering more primitive, with quotation marks, by all means, primitive cultures, as they were called at that time, when you traveled to Africa, to India, America.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Especially America.
Well, you should read some of his early letters on his first visit to Clark University. You know, he wasn't too kind about the extroverted Americans that he encountered there. But I mean, by that I mean he went to the Pueblos and talked to them, and thus the quote is him being so impressed with what little outer and quote-unquote extroverted trappings and activity they could live and still have such a meaningful, deep understanding of what life was all about.
And
it was much more closer to his own way of being than, you know, being this busybody in the collective alone.
And actually, he kept up a correspondence with Mountain Lake over the years.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, right up until the time Mountain Lake died. Yeah. Sorry, did you have a question? Observation.
I'll preface it with a bit of an apology, that I'm new to this.
Oh.
And if I step on some of the Jungian principles, I apologize.
No.
Just step on them.
You can step on them all you like.
A lot of what I've heard in your prepared remarks were about this sense of centeredness. And one of the things I wrote down, we are now living in a universe without a center.
Yeah.
One of the things that strikes me is that the rapidity with which the center, if there ever wanted to
Here.
You know, we literally black.
It's like
suddenly now we see the universe, nobody knows.
Yeah, right.
Get a sense.
Yeah.
Now maybe life on Mars. The question I have is, what does all of that do to the collective sense of who we are?
Well, I'll give you just a very personal aspect of that. When I came here from London, I didn't know where I was going to live, you know. But I was drawn to the sun. And hence, so I looked at Santa Barbara first time. Because it had come up in my dreams, you know. So I said to the real estate man who was showing me around, I said, where is the center, you know? And he was rather perplexed, but eventually he took me to a place called the Town and Country Center. It was a shopping mall. Yes.
There's something I've been sort of struggling with, I guess, over a period of time, and it comes out of Hermetic tradition, Hermes Trismegistus, and the whole notion of the holy as being out there and the God behind the stars.
Mm.
And yet the place here that we relate to that relates to that. Like, you know, in the idea of a Greek temple, you have the holy place that connects with larger than.
Yes.
In Stonehenge, you have the holy place which relates to all of the sky.
Yes,
So you have, you know, sort of the two sacred spaces, the larger sacred space and the smaller sacred space.
Yeah.
And it seems that, I mean, the idea that seems to me is that it seems that, that you are able to make contact with the larger sacred space by going through the smaller one.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's the trouble.
Right. But it's more in the line of Hermes rather than, you know, than Hestia, you know.
But I wonder, in terms of the Hermetics, how did they make that connection? What was there here that connected to there?
Well, that's a wonderful question. I couldn't answer it, I'm afraid. That's really a mind-boggling question. Yeah.
You know, there was, you mentioned Delphi area.
Yes.
Any other Greek places.
Yeah.
And when you really go to those places, you really understand why those places
are. Yeah. And I went there when I was about 12 years old. An uncle took me there. And I put my hand on this navel stone, you know, the Omphalos. I got such a charge. You know, I didn't know anything at all about this sort of stuff. You know, I was just a little kid. And he said, you know, our ancestors used to come here, you know. And this was the center of the world. And you know what a feeling that is? You know, I'm at the center of the world. Wonderful, you know. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
In the extrovert sense, we're so lost.
Yes.
Because there's no center outside.
Yeah.
And I feel like in a way that is really what Jonathan's question.
Yeah. Well, in the instance of Delphi, you know, when you go up the mountainside to get there, suddenly you're above the cloud line, and you know, just happen to know that this has to be the home of Apollo. It just is that, you know. It's a perfect place, you know. Yeah, yeah, really, yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yes, yeah.
You just turn that corner, and suddenly the sky opens up.
It's magnificent. Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah.
Let's go there.
Yeah. I'm all set. Yeah. Yeah.
Sponsor.
Yes.
I'm
yeah, please.
Because
yes.
The metaphor that just did for me, if the navel is in midpoint, my question of constantly, more rapidly exploding outwardly, is our navel shifting up? To follow that. And if so, what does that do to us as individuals as we move into the...
Have you read Toffler's book, Future Shock? I would recommend that to you. Yeah. Toffler.
Yeah.
Sorry? Well, you see, I think that's part of the problem is that we don't know. You see, that's that's where our perplexity is. That's how we're lost in a way, you see. But we do know about the inner voyage, you see. We can recreate that sense of the temenos within, you see. But as far as the extroverted approach is concerned, I just don't know. I don't think anyone does, as far as I know, you know.
I mean, it's an intriguing image that you created by saying, well, as we add more extroverted paraphernalia around us, is also our center kind of moving to take care of all of this.
Yeah.
So are we, is it leaving us? Can we still, as humans, as anthropos,
it's going so fast.
Our outer boundary, and with such our inner center, and that's the struggle.
Yeah.
That's the struggle. It's a deep struggle.
Totally.
Yeah, I'm even more new than you.
Yeah.
What I do, I've been for quite a while, that I can't live in a God by my mind.
Yes.
And so that it's the external world keeps on increasing. That's not a problem for me. It's the manifestations. It's exciting. This is what I would assume when you're saying about if we know who we are.
Yeah.
And here's the joy of the journey. Mm-hmm. You don't know where, but if you go, it's a journey.
You're right.
And it's exciting.
Yeah. That's a good attitude.
Help me expand what I do, my mind, and so I can see more and more. Mm-hmm. Like you're giving a 200 power telescope instead of the 5,000. Mm-hmm. But it's unlimited because it's bigger than what I can see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the key premise you mentioned yourself, if we know where we are.
Yeah.
And that we are good.
Yeah, and as I learn more about that, then I can see more.
Yeah,
my sense is that as all of this expands so rapidly, it becomes more and more difficult to know who we are.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's so many that don't even stop and ask.
Yes.
That causes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
You mentioned again that the archetype itself, and I tried to put that across and be honest, that it is actually a collective thing.
Yes.
And not just in that sense that it's in everyone, but
yeah.
That everyone really does have a psyche to have their spirit out there.
Right.
In some way.
Yeah.
As well as it having a psyche to have their spirit out there.
Yeah.
And it does seem like it is incumbent on us to every once in a while go back to that, because it's a curious challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so...
Well, actually, I just occurred to me that in response to what someone said was that perhaps the constellations represent some sacred space.
Mm-hmm.
And I might go out to see Orion.
Yes.
I'll go out of my way to see Orion.
Yeah.
So
well, of course, it used to be that way entirely, you know. So when you connect with that, you're doing something that has been known to your ancestors. You know. Yes?
In your discussion, I got the sense that you had both positive and negative feelings about many of the spiritual developments that are occurring now. And on one hand, you spoke of cynicism, but on the other hand, you saw it as a positive force. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on that.
Well, I just think it's what is. That's all. I don't really have feelings about it otherwise. I mean, it just is what is happening today. On the one hand, I also said it's been likened to a new renaissance, you know. But I think it's like anything else. You have to be a discerning consumer, you know, particularly today. We were overwhelmed with stuff. Someone, for example, you mentioned the internet, you know. Just dipping your toes in the internet, you know, it's overwhelming. It's mind-boggling. I can't keep up with it. But of course, I'm an introvert, you know.
What would you think about some of the movements that are highly popular, you know, like the deep act of opera and things like that?
Yeah, well, I see him as recycling the ancient wisdom of India, you know. It's really old stuff that he's, nothing new there at all, you know. But he's very popular. He knows how to market. Yeah, he's a good marketer. My wife can't stand him. I shouldn't speak. I think there is. Yeah. I think there is.
So
I think, is that, we've done it?
Okay, thank you very much.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.